Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. I'm your host, Todd Embley. And on today's show, I sit down with Professor Li Zhi Liu, one of the leading scholars shaping global understanding of China's digital economy. Li Zhi's award-winning book, From Click to Boom, explores how political institutions and digital platforms co-evolve to fuel the world's most sophisticated e-commerce ecosystem. In this episode, Li Zhi walks us through her academic journey, what sparked her interest in the political economy of tech, and the research that shaped her landmark book. She explains the scale and speed of China's e-commerce boom, the institutional innovations that enabled it, from digital payments to logistics networks, and the profound social transformations that followed. We also take a deep dive into the rise of Taobao villages, exploring how rural communities leveraged online commerce to reshape livelihoods and migration patterns. You'll come away with a deeper understanding of how China built the most advanced e-commerce market in the world and why similar growth hasn't taken place in Western economies. Enjoy.
For example, some other mechanisms that was working in the Chinese market but didn't allow in the West is that Alibaba actually built this instant messaging system to allow sellers and buyers to communicate with each other. But eBay didn't allow it because eBay charged commission on each of the transactions on their platforms. They're afraid that if they allow this private communication between sellers and buyers, people are going to strike a deal without them. However, Alibaba at the time, at the beginning, of course, they're having a free commission system. But at the same time, they realized that this kind of communication are super important to build trust in a weak rule of law environment. So they actually allow that, and that helped a lot.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation. Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies.
Liz, welcome to The Negotiation Podcast.
Thank you so much, Todd, for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
First of all, tell us a little bit about your academic background, your role at Georgetown University, how you first became interested in the intersection of politics, institutions, and e-commerce.
Sure. I am assistant professor of international business at Georgetown. Though my academic path, I would say, is a little bit more unconventional than most of my business school colleagues, because I earned my PhD in political science at Stanford, which is a discipline that rarely places, graduates in business schools. But I've always believed that when two roads diverge, it's worth taking the one less traveled. I first got my interest in e-commerce when I was doing my doctoral study at Stanford. You know, Stanford has this unique vibe of entrepreneurship, curiosity, unconventional thinking. At the time, even though most of my peers, if they study China's internet, is really about censorship, social media, which are important parts of the internet. But I heard a story at the time back then about how ordinary citizens and farmers in remote pockets of the Chinese economy started to sell online and reverse their fortune. I got really, really interested in this new economic change because I thought that's a technology shock that's going to democratize market access for ordinary people and for parts of the economy that was less connected to the national economy before. So I started to get really interested in it. I am one of the earliest US-based scholars to do the fieldwork in China. And also back then, there were very little understandings, I mean, serious academic understandings of the internal logic of this very important market, even though in China, people kind of know know it's a big deal. But in the U.S., it was before Alibaba went listed in the U.S., a lot of my professors didn't even hear or know about Jack Ma or Alibaba back then. So it was really a risky path for me. But through this study, I actually found out that e-commerce in China is not just a commercial story. It's actually something that's much deeper, much fundamental. It is about how regulatory choices by the Chinese government and has changed China's economic development trajectory. And it's actually really about how the Communist Party governs its economy. So this actually sparked my long-term interest in the intersection of politics, institutions, technology, and which continues to drive my research today.
Yeah, you touched on a couple of points that are really in my next talking point of what I want to ask you was the spark of the project and whatnot. And so we'll deep dive into that. I have a question first, though. Are you a bulldog, or are you still, like, if Stanford plays Georgetown, who are you cheering for?
Oh my gosh, that's such a difficult question. But I would say, because Stanford and Georgetown are good at very different things. So if this is about American football, I'm going to be cheering for Stanford Stanford has been doing pretty well, at least when I was at Stanford. But Georgetown is a very good player, has a very good team in basketball. So yes. I'm going to be cheering for Georgetown when there is a game in the basketball.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. One of my favorite players in the NFL is Christian McCaffrey. And he is a product. He plays for the San Francisco 49ers, funny enough, which is where Stanford is. Yeah, he's one of my favorite players, and he went to Stanford. He's a product of Stanford as well. So
I'm very proud of that. Our sports culture.
Yeah. Stanford is just such an incredible school. I kind of hope my son actually goes there as well. And you made an interesting point. I believe that quote that you mentioned of two paths diverge in a wood, and I took the one less traveled, and that has made all the difference, that Robert Frost quote. And I love that. I think, you know, that and carpe diem, probably two of my favorite kind of mantras for life. Now, as I said, I want to ask you, and you kind of mentioned where the spark for this project was, this book, right? And maybe was there a moment or a conversation or an observation, as you mentioned, and if you have anything more to add to that, what nudged you towards studying e-commerce in China from a political economy lens? Maybe you could expand on what you mentioned about your colleagues and whatnot. And then let's start there, and then I'll come back with, you know, asking you to introduce the book.
Okay, I will talk about the spark, and then perhaps what really my book is talking about. So as I said, I got super interested at the beginning because this is really a boom for ordinary people. We all heard about China's miracle, but China's miracle used to be built on this state-led investment, exports. Ordinary Chinese, of course, get part of the share of the growth, but a lot of these growth are still in the pocket of the government or like a big businesses. It's not really about the grassroots boom. But once I saw e-commerce, I got super excited because I went to Chinese villages where I've met a lot of people who are basically farmers who didn't get a lot of education. They didn't get college education. They just suddenly found some products that's suitable to be sold online. They started to sell it. They did the experiment, reversed their fortune. So I got super interested in that. But what really made me realize this is not just a commercial story is when my advisor, Jin Noi, who's a famous political scientist studying Chinese economy, she asked me, how do these people actually trust the online sales? In other words, if you are a buyer in China, you have shopped online, you saw all these like small stores from anonymous sellers. They probably are not even in the urban area. They are probably residing in somewhere that's pretty remote and in the village. How would you trust? And for A lot of these farmers, they used to be really risk averse as well, right? How do they really trust that once they ship their products to a buyer which lived in another province, they would eventually get their money back? So eventually, this is actually a question about trust. And it is not the trust, that's very easy to be built, because this is basically transactions between strangers. You know, in a country where the rule of law is not very strong, you can perhaps trade with your friends or trade with your relatives, trade with someone who's in your local market, because you can do the transaction face to face. However, we're talking about a nationwide, large scale market transaction between strangers. That's super difficult to see in a developing country where the rule of law is not really strong. And one thing about China's market, especially back in 20 years ago, when the rule of law was even weaker, a lot of counterfeits existed in the market, right? And also at the time, I would say there wasn't a very strong, high adoption of credit cards as it is in the United States. In the United States, even if there's a counterfeit, you can always get your money back because there's a high usage of credit cards. Whereas in China, all of these conditions that would solve people's trust problems were not there. So basically the question then becomes, how do people trust? Then I realized, well, this is about institutions, underlying institutions, rule of law, and why we're seeing such a big market to emerge in a country where this government-provided rule of law seems to be lacking. So basically, in my argument, or like in the book...
Fantastic topic, by the way.
Yeah, this is how I got interested. I realized, well, this is not just a technology shock. It's actually a problem that has been plaguing a lot of developing countries or countries in history for thousands of years, is that how do strangers build trust so that we can feel safe to trade with each other? So basically, my main argument is that, just to wrap this up, a lot of developing countries, they are facing a problem that the government were not able to provide very strong rule of law in the market because of political barriers or technical barriers. However, whether they can still have market growth. So my main argument is that if you look at Chinese e-commerce market, it is actually a process at which I call institutional outsourcing that made it possible to have very strong market institutions without the government providing it, which means that when the government was not able or unwilling to provide very strong rule of law in the market, it can outsource part of the development of market institutions or the enforcement of these institutions to digital platforms, such as Alibaba's Taobao, which is China's largest e-commerce market. And basically, we're seeing two things happening at the same time. So in China, especially back in 20 years ago, it was extremely difficult to foster online transaction because Chinese consumers did not trust online commerce. They have much lower commercial trust than the Western counterparts because of the lack of legal support and the lack of use of credit cards. At the time, one thing that was going on is that platforms had to invest a lot of money and brain power into building these online institutions that can solve the problem of trust. For example, Alipay, which is a combination of not just PayPal, but a compulsory escrow system that protects the transaction between sellers and buyers. If this is just PayPal, then people wouldn't trust. So you need to invest the actual layer of trust building institutions in your platform design to persuade people to actually trust online commerce. And they also invented a lot of like highly developed and semi-democratic institutions such as online jewelry in their setting. When there's a dispute, users, they can actually outsource the arbitration of the disputes to a group of panels of users. Users can vote to solve those disputes. So they developed a lot of online institutions to compensate for state institutions that's not in place. At the same time, you saw a very different story about the Chinese government, which is the Chinese government actually tolerated a lot of these experiments by digital platforms. And for a very, very long time, despite the disruptions that e-commerce has done to the Chinese economy, the Chinese government actually was pretty tolerant for the rise of these private platforms in China. They either acquiesced to its development or they actually later signed contract with these platforms and outsourced a lot of functions to them. So this is what I call institutional outsourcing. In other words, the institutions were not really built directly by the government, but through a contracting or acquiescence relationship so that it can be built by the platforms.
Holy cow. There's a lot to say in there. I mean, very, very interesting kind of conversation, even around banking and the world of banking, right. Where it's, you know, brick and mortar, and then they just kind of leapfrogged to get out front just with the internet banking or internet banking licenses that were distributed early on. The customer feedback or like the reputation building for store owners, right? It's a little bit similar to Amazon reviews, but Amazon had and has that huge company, huge backing, you know, Amazon always has your back. That had to be built almost from scratch, something that was, again, and the whole rule of law. I mean, that is 8 podcasts right there. But I think one of the things in what you said about a lot of developing countries around the world struggling with similar issues, I think one of the unique things that China has that gives them an advantage over other developing countries, most of them, is that I think as a population, China trusts their government. And I think that's an important factor in allowing a kind of filtering down and a transference of trust to whether it's local municipalities or digital platforms, digital companies, you know, whether it's your Alibabas or what have you, right? Your JDs, things like that. So anyway, I've probably just raised more questions for whoever's listening.
I would say, yes, in China, in fact, on average, I would say citizens trust their government more than to a big companies or commercial sector because of long tradition and ideological reasons. But I would say that's a factor actually going against for the online market, because why would trust the institutions that's built by a platform or private business, which is not even a state-owned enterprises. So I would say that, in fact, regardless of all of these long-held suspicions towards big platforms, private businesses, you still see the rise of very strong private institutions on platforms. I would say in countries where the businesses are traditionally very strong and citizens will trust them more so than the government, perhaps this kind of phenomenon will be even stronger. But of course, in the future.
What is left? I want to ask you to actually introduce now your work, the book From Click to Boom, The Political Economy of Economists in China. Maybe tell us about a little bit about the key concepts, arguments, and the research process that was involved with that.
Yeah, I already like kind of touch upon that. So my main argument is that when the government, especially in the developing country, they're not able or unwilling to provide rule of law in the market or very strong enforcement in the market, they can simply outsource part of the institutional development and enforcement to digital platforms, which can leverage their big data analysis and also their digital enforcement to solve a lot of problems that the government was not able to solve. And the government can basically wait and see, right? They are not doing the dirty work themselves. They just allow the private firms to experiment with new institutions. But once the platforms started to build this kind of institutions, the government can benefit from it by contracting some of the functions out to the platforms. Just to give you an example, For example, the as I said, Alipay is a very important online payment system in China with Alibaba, and Tencent has a similar thing called WeChat Pay. So essentially, it's an online payment system similar to PayPal. However, China's payment system, especially this like third-party payment system, had to be building this actual layer of trusted building mechanism so that people would trust. As I said, Alipay is actually PayPal plus a compulsory escrow system in it so that people would actually trust that. But once a lot of people are making money or they're sending money through Alipay, the government can then collaborate with Alibaba to get access to all the data that's transferring, on this like app. They can use that for enforcing, their legal institutions. For example, Alibaba back in 2015, they actually signed a contract with China's Anti-Corruption Bureau so that the Anti-Corruption Bureau in China would provide a list of businesses and individuals that ever got involved in commercial bribery and provide that information query system to Alibaba. So Alibaba, once they get their names, they can prosecute these people legally and to help the government to enforce a law. Prosecute not meaning that the government, Alibaba can put these people into jail. It only means that if these people, they already committed crime. If they move their money around online, they try to do money laundry online, or they try to purchase some high-value stuff online, Alibaba will actually prevent them from doing so and perhaps get the data and report to the government. So in other words, there has been a lot of these sort of a collaboration between the government and also the platforms in terms of legal enforcement, also anti-scam as well. And in a lot of other areas, smart city, and even the design of the contract tracing apps during China's COVID period, it was a basically outsourcing story. So the government asked the big tech companies to design those, which then get to scale up to the national level. So this is the institutional outsourcing argument I was making.
Let's go high level.
Okay.
Can you paint a broad picture of China's e-commerce market on a global scale right now?
Okay. So first of all, this market started as virtually nothing. Mm-hmm. So in early
and not that long ago.
It was so small. It was so small. And a lot of people thought that China would never make it, partly because of a trust issue and the lack of infrastructure. Now, where China stands is that it has over 800 million users domestically, and the market annual sales is more than 2 trillion per year, right? And also, just to give you something that's more like a visual. Okay, so back in 2020, China had this the world's largest online shopping event called Singles Day, which is on November 11th every year. And in 2020, which is the year that we got most data about, on that period, they generated 4 billion parcels in 2020. So if these parcels were arranged side by side, it would encircle the Earth on the equator approximately 30 times. Of course, a lot of waste. That's another sort of business opportunity out there to solve the environmental problem. But this basically tells you about the scale.
That is huge. It's we talk a lot about China's GDP, or if we're talking specifically about, Pinduoduo, Xiaohongshu, things like this, we talk about the size of their marketplace. So we talk about the pet sector and the size of the pet sector, but it's China. Like, these numbers, and I often joke, it's like talking about the distance to the sun. Like, how to possibly comprehend? It's almost hard to put it. So I like what you did there. Packages end to end, wrapping the Earth at the equator 30 times over, just to give you an idea of what one shopping festival like Singles Day, the sheer size of its power.
I would say, like, In fact, the most amazing part is not even about the volume in a single day event, right? Because of course, people are going to delay their purchase or advance their purchases and squeeze all the purchase probably for several months into that single day. So I would say that the sales number for the single day event is probably not the most amazing thing, but just to handle so many packages in an extremely short time period, that represents a lot of technology power and also logistical power. And in fact, a lot of people, if you have ever lived in China, you order something on the eve of the Singles Day, you got the package in the morning, right? Like the next day. Why is that the case? Because they already use the AI to predict how many items are going to sell at this specific warehouse that's closest to you so that they can be shipped the day after. So in fact, in early days of Singles Day, I think Alibaba did not expect the visits to be so huge, the system got down, crashed for a brief moment because of so many clicks and purchases at the same time. But later they just upgraded the system and the system never got crashed again. So that actually represents a very important leapfrog in technology power.
And logistics. You know, over 20 years ago, I did spend 4 years with UPS, United Parcel Service. And so that is something that has always absolutely fascinated me. I've had so much respect just for the logistics and how smooth and swift it is, and the volume that it can handle inside of China so seamlessly. And, you know, there's those spikes, right? You have, whether it's, you know, Chinese New Year. Now we're talking about how many millions of people that are actually traveling, the humans that are traveling all at the same time, right? And to be able to logistically handle that. And of course, packages or just same day, you know, pickup and delivery. You know, if I get to work, if I drop my phone on the way to work and my screen crashed, well, you know, a quick, call somebody, QID guy comes over or something like this, and it's gone and it's back. I mean, it's literally been 2 hours and it was somebody on the far end of Pudong, who actually is the one who fixed it. And it was back to me by lunch. I mean, it was just, I don't know. So many little aspects of it to food delivery, whatever. I mean, they're so far ahead of their time. And boy, do I miss Sherpas from Shanghai. But those who know. Okay, let's talk a little bit about what you talked about, you know, the institutional and infrastructural shifts. So what were the pivotal institutional infrastructure shifts that unlocked China's e-commerce growth? And I'm thinking now more along the lines of digital payments, yes, logistics, and then, you know, bringing in the trust mechanisms. You talked about that compulsory escrow and explained a little bit about more what that means. You know, like the money leaves me, but doesn't go to the seller for a matter of time, waiting for me to be happy and not want to return the item or something like this. And then once you explain all that, why have we not seen this in the West?
Yeah, sure. So, so I actually want to tell a story about a parallel universe where eBay is now the biggest player in China's e-commerce sector because they had a real chance in the early 2000s to actually build an e-commerce empire in China, but they didn't. So eBay is this, you know, sort of a very soft after, one of the stars in the Silicon Valley in early 2000s. And they really wanted to, win the Chinese market because they thought that whoever was going to win the Chinese market is going to win the world.
And they did very well in Japan and are still relevant in Japan.
Exactly. But in China, they basically invested in a lot of money. They initially had over 80% of the market share after their purchase of HNet, which is at the time the largest e-commerce seller, e-commerce website or platform in China. So they seem to be really doing really, really well. They're the first mover. However, Alibaba at the time is a relatively unknown company. They are getting cash flow free positive just, you know, in 2002 or something. They're not that famous and they didn't have a lot of resources. And at the time, they built a platform called Taobao, just to fend their own business. Because Alibaba used to be a B2B marketplace. It's an overseas marketplace to connect Chinese suppliers to the wholesalers in the West. However, they feel that in China, because the whole corporate sector was not very modern, and the buyers on the platform cannot really distinguish whether the seller is an individual or a business. So they feel like once eBay came to China, they're going to hurt their B2B market because it's a C2C, you know, customer to customer site, but people are going to, you know, not understanding the difference between business and individuals. So they had Taobao, which is exactly the eBay sort of model, but eBay actually withdraw from the market, you know, after 2 years or 3 years, because Taobao became basically the number one player in the market. So what's going on there? The pivotal thing is about the introduction of Alipay. And Alipay, what is that? So the reason why Alipay was there is because the early time employers, they actually figure out there's something peculiar on the platform, which is that there's so many sellers and buyers, they're very interested in trading with each other, but they just couldn't because they couldn't solve the basic trust problem, which is, should I pay the seller first or should the seller ship the product first? Because they are all worried that the other part wouldn't fulfill their contract afterward. So basically a lot of people in the old times, if they're interested in trading with each other, they only do this if they live in the same city. So they will find each other online. They talk to each other online on Taobao, but they still trade, you know, offlines without the platform. They basically meet in person. They would just exchange products and money at the same time. But this limited the scope of e-commerce market. So what they found out later is to introduce an escrow system into their online payment system, which means that if I'm the seller, if I'm the buyer, I want to buy something, I will first, my money, instead of going directly to the seller, is that it will go to Alipay and get escrowed. And the seller would actually ship the product. And only if the buyer gets a product and I'm happy with the product, the money will be released from Alipay to the seller. So on the other hand, sometimes buyer could be a cheater, right? They will receive the product without, you know, saying that I received it. They would just say, well, I didn't receive the product, but the seller will say, I already shipped that to you. So then they will enter a dispute because the money would then still get escrowed with Alipay without going back to the buyer. So the sellers, and also not to the seller. So the money will get frozen in Alipay until the two sides are happy with the transaction. So this very simple innovation in escrow system actually helped the online market to really take off. Because then even for people who do not reside in the same city, they will feel happy and okay to trading with each other. This actually unleashed a long-distance e-commerce trade. And the first Alipay transaction was actually between Japan and China. I think it was a Chinese student who studied in Japan who bought a camera somewhere on Taobao, and they were able to actually do this. So this escrow system means trust is very important. The reason why eBay didn't really make it in the Chinese market is because they sort of transplanted all their systems from the West, which was built on a high trust society, and they just moved PayPal to China without realizing that PayPal in itself is not sufficient to solve the trust gap in China. And you need to invest extra into building this trust system. For example, some other sort of mechanisms that was working in the Chinese market but didn't allow in the West is that Alibaba actually built this instant messaging system to allow sellers and buyers to communicate with each other. But eBay didn't allow it because eBay charged commission on each of the transactions on their platforms. They're afraid that if they allow this private communication between sellers and buyers, people are going to strike a deal without them.
They'll take the transaction off platform.
Yeah. Exactly. However, Alibaba at the time, at the beginning, of course, they're having a free commission system, but at the same, they sell advertisement. But at the same time, they realize that this kind of communication are super important to build trust in a weak rule of law environment. So they actually allow that, and that helped a lot. So let's go back to the question about why the West, didn't have a very, very strong e-commerce market, at least compared to China. The simple answer is that you don't have to. I would argue now you need to, but at least probably 20 years ago, you didn't have to. Because the major difference between US and China is that, West has a relatively strong, well-established offline infrastructure, and people are so used to shopping offline, right? But in China, especially if you go to lower tier cities, you can find that the number of department store per capita is much smaller in China than it is in the US or in the West. So it is the backwardness in the pre-existing business infrastructure, for example, logistics or department stores, that actually make people more attached to this like a new shopping channel. Because suddenly for people who live in a small city or even in the villages where they didn't have a lot of offline shopping options, they could shop online. And it's just very attractive because you can suddenly get access to much lower prices and a greater variety of products.
So how has e-commerce triggered social and economic transformations in China beyond the immediate marketplace, right? Yes. For example, and I'll throw a bunch of options, rural revitalization, mm-hmm. changes in migration patterns, mm-hmm. new forms of entrepreneurship, and just general changes in trust or social relations.
Yeah, actually, I think it's best captured in a small village where I visited. Mm-hmm. And it's actually one of the villages. There are thousands of villages in China like that.
Yes.
We call them Taobao villages, which are essential because a lot of these villages will trade on Taobao, the platform. But they're really the rural villages where e-commerce hits a kind of a critical mass. Usually that means that at least 10% of the household will be selling products online and engaging e-commerce. And they're at least making a sales of over 10 million RMB annually. So I visited a village called Dongfeng Village in Jiangsu province, where it was a pretty poor villages in the past. And the most prominent industry in the village used to be recycling, trash recycling. And sometimes people will refer it to as a dumping ground for those stuff. So it wasn't really a attractive place for young generation. So a lot of young people would just left the village for the cities to become migrant workers. And one villager actually told me that in the past, if an elderly person passed away, they weren't even sure they could find four young men to carry the coffin. So that was exactly the phrase they told me, just told me about the hauling out of the village because of the lack of economic prospects. But things have entirely changed because of a return migrant. And that person, he had a random visit to IKEA Shanghai, and he had this simple idea. He said, why don't I try to sell IKEA-like furniture online? Because it seems to be simple. So when he went back to the village, he couldn't find any carpenter because the industry was not there. So he basically could only find a few local coffee makers. That started to make this kind of, IKEA-like furniture. And he made his fortune really quickly. And within a month, I think he sold more than 100,000 RMB. And because villagers, it's a tight knit, community. Exactly. And gossip spreads really fast. So people started, the fellow villagers quickly learned about his money formula and they copied him. And now I remember I visited the village first time in 2014. You can see that the whole village has transformed and you have all of these wall slogans talking about the power of e-commerce. You have streets that was named as Taobao Avenue or Ma Yun Avenue, Jack Ma Avenue, talking about how e-commerce has transformed the whole village. So basically that represents you have, for example, young people coming back to the village because of the new opportunities. They get to be closer to their parents and their kids. And you also have new types of entrepreneurship because this is really a village that started from zero, from scratch. And it also affects the social relations. It's very interesting. Some people told me, actually in a couple of places, not just here, they said that before the rise of e-commerce, people easily get into some conflict because they're angry, they were not happy, they didn't have a good salary. But once they started to do e-commerce, they become so busy, right? They didn't have time for small sort of
petty arguments
with everyone. And there's even less crime. So there has been a lot of like harmonies, in the village afterward.
Very much. Well, it's also, that's changes in migration. All in that same story, rural revitalization, changes in migration patterns where people are now not afraid. The young aren't all headed to the coast, going to the major cities. They see opportunities can exist anywhere. Obviously, new forms of entrepreneurship, change in trust. And just like you said at the end there, the social relations in the cities change. I mean, when everybody is doing better and there's hope and optimism, yes. Obviously, now it's a wonderful place to live. Everybody's smiling and happy and they're kind to each other. So I love that. Yeah. So thank you. Touching on the Taobao villages, as you call them.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.